Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein on this Eclipse Monday. Coming up in the second half of today's show, my co-host Ashley Thornburg will file her eclipse report from Grand Forks. She'll visit with eclipse chaser Dr. Jared Marquise, an assistant professor at the University of North Dakota's Department of Atmospheric Sciences, who will be measuring the upper atmosphere during today's total solar eclipse. But first, we look towards the newest edition of the Dakota Digital Review with our guest, editor Patrick McCloskey. This edition covers everything from cryptocurrency to net zero emissions to artificial intelligence. It's a great resource written for non-technical folks to understand, and it's free to access. Patrick McCloskey is the editor of the Dakota Digital Review, and he joins us again on Main Street. Patrick, it's great to see you again.
Thank you, Craig. Great to see you.
Topic of the day, of course, is the Dakota Digital Review. We've talked about it before, but let's remind our listeners, what is the Dakota Digital Review and where can people access it?
The Dakota Digital Review is a magazine. It's in print and online. It's published by the North Dakota University System for the entire North Dakota University System, all the colleges and universities, but it's also for all of our residents in the area. It can be accessed online. The easiest way to do it is to Google Dakota Digital Review, NDUS, Dakota Digital Review, NDUS.
And Patrick, I think it's important for folks to think about, this is written for the layman. This is not written for the second-year graduate student in computer science.
That's true. It's not geek to geek. It's written for the rest of us, which includes most people at university who are not experts in this arena. You know, we cover what's going on, but it's also much about the social, economic, the implications of all of this technology, which is overwhelming all of us.
How often do you publish, Patrick, and do you have future plans to expand or grow the Dakota Digital Review?
Currently published in the fall semester and the spring semester. Yes, I would love to expand, but that requires a little more capacity, but that's in the works.
Just a reminder then, it is, again, available for anyone to read, teachers, students, those who are interested in technology and all things digital should take a look at this. I want to go through and step through, Patrick, some of the just very interesting articles that are in this edition. The cover story of sorts is Net Zero, A Path to Zero Growth by Mark Mills.
Well, Mark hits on the unrealistic plan to simply get to net zero as if we could get there by his analogy is, choosing zero Coke, that it's something we can pull off the shelf, which is not practical in the slightest. The motivation partly is all the trillions of dollars that we would need for the transition, which I think pushes a lot of the big power brokers in this direction. But we have to look at how practical is it and do we need it in the first place? He doesn't go into any arguments about climate change per se. However, he does bring in Steve Koonin, who was President Obama's expert on renewable energy, who wrote a book called Unsettled. And he makes the claim and substantiates the claim that there is no climate emergency. So we do have time to figure out how to provide affordable, reliable energy, both with hydrocarbons and with alternatives.
Here's something that I've wondered about, and we've visited about this a little bit, Patrick. You take all of the power that's consumed in the United States today. Let's put that in a bucket. Mm-hmm. Now, let's figure out all the power that's going to be needed in a decade or two to power artificial intelligence. Those buckets would be equal in size and in needed capacity. In other words, we're going to need double the power in the future. We won't be using less power by all estimates.
No, not at all. Just as you said, AI alone, to train AI, run AI, will consume the entire world's energy output in the future. As well, energy demands always rise. They don't go down. So how do we catch up to that exactly? The more demand, the higher the price. So we actually have a double quandary of how do we provide for the world? Because if we don't have affordable energy that's reliable and inexpensive, the economic future of people on this planet, especially the poor, is much, much under stress. At the same time, how do we then power artificial intelligence, which provides enormous benefits and solves a lot of problems?
We're going to talk about some of those problems and some of those advantages of AI here in just a moment that is included in this issue of the Dakota Digital Review. Good article by Mark Mills. Well thought out, poses a lot of questions for people to think about. The next article I want to talk about talks about something that I've heard many debates about in state legislatures. and it's the idea of central bank digital currencies and then Bitcoin, and what's the difference, and what about privacy and control?
Oh, exactly. That's the main crux of all of the discussions is privacy and control. So in this article, Professor Fries outlines what exactly these both are and what they share and what they differ about. They share the properties of money, which is important. They're fungible, meaning you can exchange one Bitcoin for another, a dollar for another. And he uses the example of sheaves of wheat in the past, which didn't have the same value, etc. And, you know, store of value, highly divisible, rare, single spend. You know, you can't spend it once and then spend it again with somebody else. All of these things have been worked out over the centuries regarding money as we know it. But going forward in the digital world, two things have popped up. One is Bitcoin, which is anonymous, and that's its main advantage for people, that no one knows. I mean, the public keys are there, the public ledger is there, but no one knows who owns anything, who's receiving anything. But with CBDCs, you have advantages such that if you lost your key to it, it could be recoverable. And it does allow for large transfers, for example, between governments and large corporations at basically the speed of light. So there are massive advantages. The problem comes in with, as you said, control. Now, he does point out that banks already can exercise a lot of control. You know, your transactions are tracked and banks could debank you. That's happened in Canada, for example. However, with CBDCs, it greatly increases that.
Regulatory issues.
Regulatory issues, indeed. And also capacity issues. The government can see and regulate on a, you know, transaction by transaction basis.
Do you own any Bitcoin, Patrick?
Unfortunately, I do not.
So I was given as a Christmas gift several years ago, $5 worth of Bitcoin.
Oh, voilà.
But for me, that was on a different phone that had a different app. And Lord knows where that $5 of Bitcoin is. I don't. And now I don't have any way to reaccess that. This article kind of made me think about that just a little bit.
No, exactly. I have friends who would today be multimillionaires had they not lost their keys.
Ooh.
And that is a huge, huge disadvantage. But in terms of anonymity, you know, cash is, of course, anonymous, but it's under stress.
Let's move on in this edition of the Dakota Digital Review. Article titled Imagination, and that AGI in the middle of imagination is the path to artificial general intelligence. Fascinating article.
AGI, I mean, we're just getting used to narrow AI, you know, with these programs winning at chess and at Go, and we have the large language models. And on the horizon is AGI, which, you know, I'll read a definition so that we can get it straight. AI systems that are generally smarter than humans. So the idea is that it's artificial general. The general thing is the important part because it means that these machine systems, these algorithms, learn and teach themselves but can be applied to many, many different areas, so they can think like a human being. They can have the same level of cognition and the capacity to reason, learn, problem solve, perception, language. Basically function across a wide range of tasks the way, an intelligent human would do.
The article is written by Atif Farid Muhammad. We've got a ways to go in our journey for AI, for sure. Mm-hmm. However, it's impacting us in ways that many of us don't even know about already today.
Oh, it sure is. I mean, it's been around a long time. And anytime you've accessed your smartphone over the years, it's there, and computers, etc. But it's kind of broken into the public sphere with large language models, which have shocked everybody into, you know, wow, we can, you know, put in these prompts and get an entire article. Or now you can put in a prompt and get an entire video. So this stuff is just mushrooming.
Back to cryptocurrency, scams and what to watch for. I guess it goes back to my ineptitude of losing my keys to my cryptocurrency, among other things.
Yeah, she's a director of digital forensic services at Dakota State University. So she's right in the thick of it, dealing with a lot of these criminal cases. And there are a number of them that they will sound familiar because they've been around for a long time, but now they've moved into cryptocurrency. One is the investment romance scam, where someone, you know, woman contacts through Facebook and begins this relationship and then, you know, says, oh, I make all this money on cryptocurrency and tries to get someone to invest. And, of course, that turns into to a complete scam.
Somebody always bites it. Apparently.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, people sometimes are lonely. They think, well, I have a friend, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, the tech support scam is really interesting because I'm sure everybody's had it. You turn on your computer, you get this loud noise, and they try to convince you that that your computer's been has been infected. Now, just this year, there was a movie called The Beekeeper, which is a Jason Statham movie, and he's, you know, big action hero sort of thing. And they use that to begin and powers the entire movie, you know, that an elderly woman, you know, thinks that, oh, my God, my computer's been infected and basically hands over, you know, control of the computer. And then they can access all the accounts and just drain everything out. Or in this case, they have this more sophisticated scam if you can't get to it directly, where they convince somebody, like they know how much you've got, and they put in all this extra money and they say, oh, you got to pay us back. It was a mistake. And then they get people to run around and pay them back in cash. And then, of course, they realize that there was never money in there in the first place.
There are some strategies, though, that people should consider. And I think that Erica does a good job in recommending how individuals can protect themselves from cryptocurrency scams.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, if it sounds too good, it is too good.
Up in the ag world next, innovative approaches to destroying herbicide-resistant weeds. And I should note, we'll have a Harvest Media essay soon here on Prairie Public about robots who can identify plants.
You know, the context is that for 70 years, we've worked on this problem worldwide. And controlling weeds has led to the increase in food production such that the world population has tripled, which is absolutely phenomenal. The paradox is that as weeds are treated, they also gain resistance. So the weeds keep coming back. And now we have this, you know, it's actually written by the director of Grand Farm, this, you know, this arms race between chemical companies and herbicide and, you know, and these weeds, which is very difficult. These weeds are very clever.
Unfortunately. And they are in my garden too, by the way. More artificial intelligence here, the rebalancing our brain, the crisis of meaning in the age of AI, something I haven't really thought about, but boy, after you read the article, it makes you wonder just a little bit how society can maintain a sense of meaning in this purpose, in this age, excuse me, of artificial intelligence. It's a topic. It's just very timely.
Well, I think it is, and it's rather eye-opening because everybody has a sense of the world spinning out of control, but nobody quite can put their finger on why and what to do about it. And, Todd Pringle, who's finishing his PhD in psychology and at DSU, wrote this really brilliant article about Ian McGilchrist, who wrote The Master and His Emissary, who's a psychiatrist, but he started out as actually teaching literature, about how since the Renaissance, we've transitioned from a balanced view of the world to one dominated by the left hemisphere. And to understand that, he often uses the McGilchrist, the analogy of a chicken, which with one eye, you know, will reach down and zero in on a grain of wheat and pick it up and eat it. The other eye is surveilling around so that the chicken doesn't become the meal for the fox, sort of thing. So we both have this split hemisphere view of the world, such that we can, with the left hemisphere, zero in and do things, grasp things, accomplish things, and the right hemisphere, surveil. And on the cultural and more sophisticated level, that sort of translates into how we experience life, the left hemisphere being more the side of precise language and reason, etc. And we've gone more and more into the left hemisphere's manipulation, control, technology, which reduces the more holistic, poetic, spiritual experience of life down to more mechanistic terms. And AI is now speeding that up, kind of putting it on steroids. So we're pushed more and more into this way of looking at things, which has a lot of benefits. We've benefited greatly through technology. But we lose a sense of meaning. We lose a sense of hope. you know, the analogy is kind of operates like zombies, you know, kind of wander around. and surveys show that the majority of people feel they're leading a meaningless existence as a result. So we have the material benefits, but we lost the poetry, the sacred, the beautiful, and all, you know, the things that we need to feel fulfilled as well as operate in the world.
Just an aside, Dr. McGilchrist has been one of my most favorite guests I've ever had on Main Street, Patrick, and that was due to your suggesting that we visit, and I surely enjoyed that, and thank you for it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Very much a lot of fun. We're just going to mention a title of an article that's in the Dakota Digital Review, and we are enjoying our conversation with Patrick McCloskey. He's the editor of the Dakota Digital Review. The newest edition has hit the streets, as they say, both online and in print. There's a story about how cyber insurance prevents post-cyber attack disaster. Just a guide, I guess, that businesses and others can look at to think about what compliance and what are essential procedures they should have in place. Patrick, on to the next article, History of Digital's Black Hole. This is something I have thought about before, and the title is Challenges to Preserving Records in the iPhone Era. Has to do with your background, print, my background, print. We printed these newspapers. They could be archived, and we could go at them later. In my home county, there's this digital presence that sprung up, and I've always wondered, okay, as soon as somebody doesn't fund that website anymore, all that data, all of those stories, so to speak, are going to disappear, and this article made me think about that.
No, exactly. That's a huge problem, because not only, you know, if things get unplugged or they disappear, but even when things are preserved, like, for example, you have photos on your iPhone, you have stories in a CD or something like that, people can't access it. You know, there's passwords. Plus, you know, we used to have, you know, drawers full of photos, right? And generations later, these photos would still be there. But now, you know, somebody takes a million photos in their life. It's, you know, who's gonna even know to go and try to get them and break the code and get there? You know, people used to donate pounds and pounds of photos and whatever to museums. They'd go through them, pick out what was useful, what was not. Now it's much, much more difficult to access, you know, stuff from people, but also often, depending what state you're in, even newspapers, because, you know, fortunately in North Dakota, every printed newspaper has to provide a copy to the state archives. And they've been working with the online to make sure that that happens as well.
You know, I wondered about this. I use Google Cloud Storage, and I pay a couple extra bucks a month, and I have a couple terabytes out there, and my phone is set to back up every photo I take and slap it right up there. Well, that's all going to work well and good until I'm not paying 10 bucks a month anymore. And then what's going to happen? And I've thought about that. I need to figure out a solution to that.
Exactly.
And this article kind of bends me towards doing that sooner rather than later. The last article we're going to chat about today in this edition of the Dakota Digital Review is how AI will improve, not destroy, our jobs. There are workforce challenges in the AI economy.
Yeah, this is a piece by Sean Riley, who is the CIO of the state of North Dakota. He's pretty optimistic about AI and workforce. I mean, he acknowledges that there might be some difficult transitions, because up to half, a third, who knows how many of jobs will disappear as mechanization, I mean, as automation and AI can take over a lot of these tasks, which he points out are typically the kinds of things we don't want to do anyway. They're very boring and, you know, that sort of thing. At the same time, new jobs will be created. Most of the high-paying jobs now, a lot of them, didn't even exist 5 years ago. Currently, there's something like 800,000 open AI-related jobs across the country. Well, if we were talking about this 5-10 years ago, there weren't any. There were zero, right? So it creates something of an issue for people in the workforce. You have to prepare for changing jobs, changing arenas you work in, which, you know, I think complicates things. But as he points out, accountancy is a pretty routine sort of job, and certainly accountant firms will have fewer and fewer accountants. So what do those people do? Well, they have the training for a whole nexus of jobs, as he points out, in finance, et cetera, et cetera. As well, one interesting thing I noticed in one of the graphs he gave is that craft and related trade workers are somewhat the least impacted. So, you know, these days I tell students, well, yeah, whatever you're studying, take cyber courses. You're going to need it in AI. And you might want to think about having a trade because we're going to need people to repair the air conditioning and build certain things. You can't outsource it very easily. So it provides, you know, I think a challenge going forward, but there's a lot of opportunities, new kinds of jobs. And a lot of the jobs, like in manufacturing, are more high level where someone on the manufacturing floor has these, you know, CMC or very high-end AI machines that they operate. So it requires a higher level of intelligence and training and a lot more, you know, a lot more interesting.
My kids and I have had several discussions on if they were going to pick a major in college today, considering what AI may do to that major, would they pick the same major? And two of my three kids say yes. One has said no, because she will be impacted more likely than not by AI at some time in the future and is very concerned about it in her vocation.
Yeah. A note to that, I've been in conferences where at universities where they ask people in industry, well, what do you want? How do you want us to prepare people? And they say, well, we want people to get a really good, solid education, not necessarily so much about this particular industry. We will train them in the industry, which is what their milieu, they're up with it. Universities have trouble keeping up with all of these things. So education still has a wonderful function. But we don't – I think we need to stress out less in education if we're getting a good education, you know, in the job market.
Patrick, who can contribute to the Dakota Digital Review for future editions?
Anyone. Anyone anywhere in the world. I set this up such that I would work with people with expertise, and that means you might have a PhD, you might be a professor, you might be self-taught. I don't really care. If you have expertise and you want to write for a wider public as a public intellectual, I'll help you through the process.
What's next? What's on the back burner, so to speak, for future editions, Patrick?
Well, in the fall issue, I'm going to do a number of things, at least one or two things about data centers, because that's on the horizon in North Dakota. Again, agriculture. I hope to have a series of articles about ag tech with Grand Farm and NDSU, and also more about energy. UND has massive capacity there. So,
again, Patrick McCloskey is the editor of the Dakota Digital Review. He has joined us again today on Main Street. Patrick, again, one more time. If people want more information about this publication, how can they find it and how can they use it?
Google Dakota Digital Review, NDUS. You can also email me at ddainfo@ndus.edu. That's ddainfo@ndus.edu. If you want a letter to the editor, you want to propose an article, you just want to be on the mailing list, whatever it is, I'm reaching.
Even out. Maybe a science fiction article you would consider.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've been hoping to find people who would be interested in the arts who would contribute. You know, the limitations has to have something to do with technology. So,
Patrick, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
More Main Street's ahead. It's Eclipse Day. Stay with us.
Debate season is here, and Prairie Public will host a pretty big one for this part of the world. It's the Republican primary contest for governor of North Dakota. I'm Dave Thompson. Join me and the candidates, Congressman Kelly Armstrong and Lieutenant Governor Tammy Miller, Tuesday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain. You can listen on a radio, a smart speaker or app, watch Prairie Public television service, or stream online at prairiepublic.org. Prairie Public's Election 2024 coverage is made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
And we're back on Main Street. I am Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is someone who, like millions and millions of us, looking up to the skies today because it is that long-awaited total solar eclipse. I'm joined now by Dr. Jared Marquis. He is an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of North Dakota, and he is the North Dakota team leader for the Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project. Dr. Marquis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
The Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project, what is that?
So it's a NASA-funded project that is actually started a couple years ago, bringing in several universities and colleges across the United States. So I think it's up to 70-ish colleges across the U.S., or 70 teams. And there's two tracks with it. There's an atmospheric science track, which North Dakota team is part of, and an engineering track. And the atmospheric science track, we went out in October for the annular solar eclipse to Colorado and launched these high-altitude weather balloons every hour for 30 straight hours centered around the eclipse. So overnight.
Oh, you know how to have a good time.
Yeah. So lots of sleep deprivation, a very stinky van ride down there and back. So all sorts of fun, but we launched these high-altitude balloons that go up. They were going up to about 125,000, 130,000 feet, so way up there. Take about 3 hours to go up and come back down.
What does a plane fly at?
Like 30,000, 40,000 feet. So
and what did you say these balloons are?
About 120,000, 130,000 feet.
Whoa!
Yeah. So, yeah, they go up there, take a long time to go up, and take a long time to come back down.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
But they do come back down to, to the same spot even?
No. So, obviously, there's winds above the ground, and we're able to measure those, and we're able to track it as it goes up. And in Colorado, they were actually following about 150 miles to the east of us. They were getting blown by the upper atmospheric winds and falling out there. And we actually, as we were driving back, we got a call from a small town of center North Dakota where one of them actually got caught in a power line.
Oh, dear.
And it was funny because we had just filled up for gas about an hour earlier, like in the town 5 minutes from where it got caught in the power line.
Oh.
So, but everything was fine and they were able to take it down with no problem. So, yeah.
Why are you launching these balloons?
Yeah, so there's several reasons. Solar eclipses aren't very common, as I'm sure everybody knows, which is why it's so exciting. And we have some ideas of what should happen to the atmosphere during the solar eclipse, but we don't have a lot of measurements. And there's a few reasons for that. Obviously, we have a lot of ground measurements because we have ground weather stations kind of all over the place. But when it comes to getting information off of the ground, it's a lot harder. So a lot of times we'll use weather balloons to get information about the atmosphere as a whole. But those weather balloons, at least historically, are only launched twice a day from a few National Weather Service offices. I think it's a total of about 100 across the U.S. So if you want to see what happens during an eclipse, well, you need to launch more often than that, hence the hourly. So it allows us to measure things like atmospheric temperature, atmospheric humidity, atmospheric pressure, wind speed, wind direction, all of that throughout the entire atmospheric column up to that 120,000, 130,000 feet with really high kind of temporal resolution when we're launching every hour, which is 12 times more than most people or most of the Weather Service offices launch. So we can get that full three-dimensional view of kind of what impacts the eclipse is having on the atmosphere.
Okay, I'll ask that question. What impact are eclipses having on the atmosphere?
So, a lot. So you can think about, during a hot summer day, right? Even if it's not windy when you wake up in the morning, there's usually a nice little breeze during the summer day, right?
Sure.
So a lot of that is due to kind of uneven surface heating from the sun. So some places warm up more than others. As you probably know, a parking lot warms up a lot more than a lake, hence why everyone wants to spend their days at lakes and not parking lots. But
yeah, nothing about the beauty.
Yeah. Sea of concrete, right? So this uneven surface heating is causing what's called convection and convective turbulence. And you can actually feel it when you are in a plane. When you're going up in a plane and taking off or landing, you can feel when you fly over those parking lots where you kind of feel like you're getting lifted up. And so that's these turbulent bubbles or these convective bubbles that are rising up off of that parking lot. So obviously, if the sun is turning off for part of the day, which is what I like to call the eclipse.
That's the scientific term.
Yeah, very scientific,
right?
Yeah.
Sun's taking a nap.
Then you lose that. So there's impacts to wind fields and stuff like that. And we are able to model it, but verifying whether we're modeling it correctly is another thing we want to look at. And even though they're a super rare event, there's the possibility of tornadoes down in Texas today, along that track of totality. So, yeah, it's only once every 10 years that we have impacts from these eclipses, but if you're the one whose town is getting hit by a tornado that day, It doesn't matter that it was once every 10 years. You want to know what's going to happen. You don't want the weather people to be like, hey, sorry, there's an eclipse. Don't trust our weather today.
Yeah, I should say not. Does it impact other things? Like, I mean, I couldn't help but notice we were walking up a stairwell called air traffic control.
Yeah.
Do people running air traffic control have special concerns right now?
I'm sure they do. I actually don't know personally, but I do know when we were in October, the amount of aircraft that were flying over, even though we had told them, hey, we're launching balloons here, don't fly over here. There's a lot of people who may not pay attention, especially some of the general aviation pilots who were also flying over the national park nearby, which is also not where they were supposed to be flying. So in terms of air traffic control and kind of monitoring the airways, I'm sure that it gets very congested, just like the roads are, because everyone thinks, hey, if I can't get there because the roads are packed, I'll just hire out an airplane.
Okay, I know you gave us the proper assistant professor of atmospheric sciences answer of the sun is taking a little nap right now. But really, what is happening? What is a solar eclipse?
Yep.
How is it different from a lunar eclipse?
Yeah.
Besides the very obvious.
Yeah, so if you believe the Earth is round, which you should, the moon orbits around the Earth and the Earth orbits around the sun. And as the moon orbits around the Earth, it doesn't orbit perfectly around the equator the entire time. It's tilted a little bit. So it's only once or twice a year that that tilt in that orbit is actually lined up perfectly that we can get solar and lunar eclipses. It has to be where the moon is in its tilt on the Earth has to meet up with the Earth-Sun kind of plane there for it to get in front of either the Earth to get in front of the sun between the moon and the sun, or the moon to get between the Earth and the sun. So for a lunar eclipse, what's happening is the Earth is blocking the sun from hitting the moon. So when you look up on a full moon night, you can see that the moon fully illuminated. That is because the sun is illuminating the moon. And if the Earth goes between the sun and the moon, then the Earth is casting a shadow, and the moon ends up in the Earth's shadow. So while the moon is in the Earth's shadow, it gets dark, and a lot of times you'll hear it called a blood moon because it turns that kind of reddish color, which you'll see in shadows sometimes. Well, the opposite is true for a solar eclipse. The moon passes between the Earth and the sun so that the Earth is now seeing some of the moon's shadow on the Earth. And in doing so, you end up with turning off the sun. You block out the sun. So the reason why the total solar eclipse is so rare is because the moon is much smaller than the Earth. So the Earth has a really big shadow, but the moon's shadow is much smaller. The moon, we actually live in a time now where the moon is approximately the same size as the sun. And if you go back several million years, that wasn't the case. The moon was much larger than the sun. And the moon is slowly over millions of years, I think it's something like a couple centimeters a year, getting a little bit further out from the Earth every year. So several million years from now, there's going to be no solar eclipses anymore. So we live in that perfect sweet spot where the sun and the moon are about the same size. Now, that can also make things complicated for solar eclipses, too. Back in October, we had what's called an annular eclipse. So in that case, the moon seemed to be smaller, at least visually, than the sun. So when the moon passed in front of the sun, you had this ring of sun around the outside of the moon. So you can do something similar to make it look like that. You can get like a tennis ball and a flashlight and hold the flashlight and bring the tennis ball in front. And depending on where you put that tennis ball, you'll see a different shadow. And that's what's happening on the Earth. So
I'm just going to imagine, you know, a celestial being taking a tennis ball and a giant flashlight. And that's what's causing the eclipse right now. We're visiting today with Dr. Jared Marquis. He is an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of North Dakota, and he is also the state team leader on the Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project, an effort to launch weather balloons on an hourly basis during this big solar eclipse day. Where is the rest of your team?
Yeah,
it's just you and me in this room.
Yeah,
up in a radar penthouse, I believe.
Yeah,
never been in a penthouse before.
A lot more dead flies than you expected,
yeah,
right?
I'm just gonna say.
Our team was deployed to Upland, Indiana for this. So they drove out. They woke up early, left the parking lot here at 5 o'clock in the morning, Friday morning, and got out to Upland, Indiana about, I think, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time, on early Saturday morning. Oof. And were able to rest a little bit on Saturday. And since then, they've been setting up and starting to launch balloons yesterday afternoon. So they're out underneath the path of totality. Actually, looks like they might be cloud-free, unlike us here.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. So, they've started launching balloons. They've actually teamed up with the Minnesota team, which includes St. Catharines, St. Cloud, and Fond du Lac Tribal Community College at Taylor University in Upland, Indiana. And so between the two teams, we're actually launching every half hour. So we got a little super site going.
So what are you seeing so far?
So last night was a little bit hectic. There were some thunderstorms in the area, and obviously we don't want people out trying to fill up these high altitude weather balloons and thunderstorms and possibly getting struck by lightning. So there were a couple times where it was like, okay, everyone get inside. Let's stay, make sure no one gets struck by lightning for a little while, and then we'll launch this one 15, 20 minutes late, right? And then there were wind shifts throughout the night. The wind shifted from easterly to westerly as a little front pass through with those showers. So that ended up requiring them to track all of the supplies and ground stations and antennas through a building to get to the other side of the building so that they could still see the balloons and have that direct sight with the antenna to the balloon, because they were losing the balloons not at 100,000 feet, but at 10,000, 20,000 feet.
Wow. How much does a project like this cost?
A lot of money. I don't have anything in terms of the total cost for the project as a whole, but I do know that helium is expensive. Each of the balloons themselves is about $60-75, and then the sensor packages themselves are roughly about $300-400, one-time use, which is expensive. You can see now why the National Weather Service is only launched twice per day as opposed to once every hour. So it can get extremely expensive, especially when you include the helium. We have these giant helium tanks, and we get three, maybe four launches out of a helium tank because we have these big balloons that when we launch them, they're something like 4 or 5 feet in diameter. So they're very big, and then they get larger than like an SUV as they go up in the atmosphere before they rip and pop.
Okay, yeah. How come I've never seen one? Is that just because they're going up way too high before they inflate and only twice a day, I guess?
Yeah, so there's a few reasons.
I feel like I'd notice an SUV in the sky.
Yeah, so there's a few reasons. Firstly, they're launched twice a day, so that we'll be at universal time, universal coordinated time, UTC.
Okay.
And this is at 0Z and 12Z, so midnight and noon, universal time, which is for us right now 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And the only places nearby that are launching them are Duluth and Bismarck and Aberdeen. So unless the winds are right, it's not going to fly over our area. But you can see them. People have got them as they come back down, had them planted in trees or in their backyard and whatnot. Mm.
What should a person do if that happens?
So there's a sticker on it that says, hey, this is harmless. You can give us a call. Several people found them from our deployment in October, and they gave me a call, and I was like, hey, if you want to send it back to us, you can. Otherwise, like, we can't do anything with it again, so you can keep it. And there were several people. There was one gentleman that I talked to who his kids brought it for show and tell. So they had this giant balloon and all of this, like, 100 feet of string attached to it in this little sensor package. So we can't use it again. So we use it for teaching purposes, but we have a bunch that we can use for that. So if you find it, I know the National Weather Service ones have prepaid postage on them, so you can just drop them off at the post office. But for us, for our scientific project, we don't need to have a whole bunch of used ones sitting in a bin somewhere. I think it's better that somebody gets some scientific enjoyment out of it.
So we've mentioned clouds. Obviously, ideally, on a solar eclipse day.
Yep.
You don't super want clouds.
Yeah.
Just emotionally, I guess. Where you at with that?
So it's a little disappointing. I'd like to definitely see part of the sun go to sleep. but I did see the eclipse back in 2017.
Yeah.
From Wyoming. So I did have that experience. And then down in October, we had the annular, the Ring of Fire eclipse, which was really cool to see as well. So it is disappointing to miss out on this eclipse.
Yeah.
That said, I also think it might have been kind of cool to have totality come through when it's a cloudy day, because then you don't see the sun go away. It just gets dark with the clouds.
Yeah, I mean, we are recording this during totality. It hasn't been a noticeable change.
Yeah, I think with us sitting here, our eyes are just kind of getting used to it, so
it's
getting
like
a little
frog
bit darker.
In the pot kind
yeah,
of thing.
I think if we were in a cubicle somewhere and then came up to here after a while, we could notice it a little bit better.
Mm.
So, unfortunately, it's cloudy, but thankfully I didn't have to travel for the cloudiness. The cloudiness came to me. It's actually unfortunate. There's a stationary front from the clouds that we're getting, this low pressure system. There's a stationary front attached to it that goes down pretty much right along the path of totality through Texas and Arkansas and all that. And
right.
A lot of places are not going to be able to see the eclipse, and a lot of people probably spent a lot of money going out there to see the eclipse, and now they have to deal with clouds. So, unfortunately.
Are we still getting the data we're after?
Yeah.
Using we very loosely here.
Yeah, so we still have weather stations across the U.S. that are getting data. Mm-hmm. We still have even teams from this eclipse project who are deployed in Texas who are launching balloons down there. As long as there's no thunderstorms ongoing, they'll be launching balloons. So we still have data throughout this entire track, whether it's cloudy or not. And as much as the clear sky data is really cool, the cloudy data is really cool too, because models don't get to choose whether, and whether you don't get to choose whether it's going to be cloudy or not. You still want to know the impacts of when it is cloudy. So all data is good data.
So are you monitoring this in real time, or are you going to be looking at this data, you know, after the fact?
So a lot of it is looking at it after the fact. Some of it, there is monitoring that is ongoing, mostly to kind of be like, hey, we should look at this later, or hey, we had a problem with this. Last night, and for example, last night we had a couple launches that were delayed by 20 minutes. So, and looking at comparisons between days, we may have to kind of take advantage of that data and the documentation that we made about, hey, these were delayed a little bit because we had lightning. So there is a lot of data recording going on right now, a lot of handwritten notes going on right now as well. But a lot of it will kind of hit the ground with data processing when they get back.
And who's using the data ultimately? Is this for weather forecasting? Is this for cloud seeding? Is this for...
So a lot of it is being used by NASA.
Okay.
So they're looking for something called atmospheric gravity waves. So these are similar to waves in a lake or an ocean. You get waves in the atmosphere. The atmosphere acts a lot like a fluid, and you can actually see this a lot of times if you look at the clouds. Maybe not today, but some days you'll see what looks like wave patterns in the clouds. And so you get these things called atmospheric gravity waves that should be generated by the eclipse. And sometimes with some data that they saw back in an eclipse in 2020 in South America, the balloon actually stopped ascending, descended a little bit in this gravity wave, and then went back up on its own. So kind of monitoring all of these solar eclipse impacts and what they do, as well as researchers who are going to look at data to see, okay, what impacts is this having on weather models? Are we getting it right, sort of thing?
North Dakota will be in the path of totality in 2044.
Yep.
Put a note in your Google Calendar now. What are you going to be doing?
That's a good question. I don't know what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. 2044, I will probably be collecting data somewhere, maybe in North Dakota. I know there's also another solar eclipse in 2045 going similar to the eclipse in 2017, kind of through California and the central Gulf states in that. So maybe there's another project on the horizon where we have two eclipses back-to-back again.
Dr. Jared Marquis, the North Dakota team leader for the Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project, is also an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of North Dakota. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Pray Public is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
Whether you're a sustaining member, or you give annually, or you've made additional contributions to Pray Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Pray Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Police lie. They do so to motivate confessions, to hide undercover, and to solve cases. But is this morally acceptable? On the next episode of Why, we'll explore whether the deceptions of law enforcement are compatible with justice. So join me and my guest, Luke William Hunt, for Police and the Ethics of Lying on Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 8th. After midnight, on this date in 1952, Spike Jones and his City Slickers were still playing their notorious musical depreciation review of 1952 for over 7,000 fans at the UND Fieldhouse. According to this day's evening edition of the Grand Forks Herald, individual performers had kept spectators occupied starting at 8:30 until the set was ready for the main show, which then started 2 hours late. As the entertainers took their bows after midnight, members of the audience were reported to have become laugh-sick. The Herald also reported that the group's delayed start was caused by a baggage car derailing near Staples, Minnesota. The Grand Forks chapter of Disabled American Veterans sponsored this greatly anticipated concert. Tickets were $1.50, $2.50, and $3.50 at Scott's Music Shop. Spike Jones became a star in 1942 when he satirized Adolf Hitler with his hit single, Der Führer's Face. It featured the line, "Heil," followed by a Bronx cheer. The song would later be featured in a Disney cartoon with the same name, starring Donald Duck. Spike Jones and his City Slickers became known for what the Dakota student charitably called each unusual sound from each unique instrument. The comedy musical group would also play 5 years later on March 8, 1957 at the North Dakota Winter Show in Valley City. A promotional catchphrase for the group claimed that Spike Jones was the man who set music back 10,000 years. He was too modest. Along with antics, which, on a scale of 1 to 10, brought zaniness up to 11, he and his band wore perhaps the classiest suits that could have been made from window curtains and couch upholstery. Spike Jones and his City Slickers frequently performed in drag. One of their songs went, "It's tough to be a girl musician, especially if you happen to be a man." Jones, the clown prince of musical comedy, would have a profound influence on future generations of artists. These included Dr. Demento, Weird Al Yankovic, and North Dakota native Peter Shickley, who was a senior at Fargo Central High at the time of the 1952 performance. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have been with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll catch up with the most current research on weight loss drugs and diabetes in a special Conversations on Healthcare. And we'll air segments from an important discussion that was recently held at Concordia College, where former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat, and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer, a Republican, addressed the issue of civility in these tense political times. That's all tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.